Well, everybody, Star Trek Discovery is over, at least for this season. So what are we going to do now? How about we steal the Enterprise?
Are you insane?
They are insane!
You're in the hands of an adolescent.
It is a cellular peptide cake.
But Matt Frosting.
It does like you.
How you doing, Mike?
That man is bereft of passion and imagination.
Mr. Kim.
Hi, Christopher. I'm Nero.
Let the lesson begin.
You're carving us up like a roast.
I hear you, Trudy, isn't it?
All right. Welcome back. My name is Mike McCafferty. I have a podcast called I Just Want to Talk About Star Trek. And for the past 15 weeks or so, actually for past like 5 months, all we've done is talk about Star Trek Discovery with a few interludes here and there, because that has been the series which has been on. Star Trek Discovery, it's been on. And so we talked about it and talked about it and talked about it, because we've been diligent about talking about new Star Trek. But now it's over. And so now I get to talk about whatever I want to talk about. In fact, I probably could have talked about whatever I wanted to talk about whenever I want to talk about. It's my podcast. I am beholden to no one right now. I'm in sort of this nexus between Feral Audio, and Starburns Audio. I have to sign some paperwork with that sort of stuff. So until then, I can do whatever I want. I could have done whatever I wanted whenever I want. But right now, I'm completely untethered. And I am without co-hosts. I have jettisoned them. I have separated the sausage section of this podcast because I wanted to get kind of a palate cleanser for me. I've been talking about Discovery with Kim and with Jason and sometimes with Dave Michelson or Callie or John Stern or whomever. And it's brought me down. It brings me down, not because I hate the show so much. Although if you listen to the podcast, I really have a lot of issues with it. But I have a problem with it being Star Trek. We know that. I don't want to go over this. It's fascinating because, you know, recently as I've been kind of like scanning Reddit and all these other places, you know, some people have actually on Reddit have postulated, well, maybe the problem isn't Discovery not syncing up with the original series. Maybe it's the problem with the original series syncing up with everything else. Maybe we should decanonize the original series, which makes me feel like I'm losing my mind. You want to eradicate the original series. People say because stylistically it looks different than Discovery, and then later on Next Generation, that it is the outlier. And some people say, oh, in fact, maybe this is just some sort of hollow novel written by a Ferengi, which makes me almost want to have tears flow from my eyes. Vulcan tears, the Vulcan tear episode, where I can't understand that. I have to remind myself that this is, in fact, a different generation of people. People who have never watched the original series. People have never even watched Next Generation sometimes. People who are of a certain age. You know, if they always say with Doctor Who, you fall in love with your first doctor, whatever doctor you watch. It's your first doctor from you is Tom Baker. And then later on is David Tennant. My son loves Matt Smith. Some people love Christopher Eccleston. Some people love the first doctor. And you fall in love with these people, sometimes to the detriment of others. But really, I would hope that we'd all eventually learn to embrace all of these. And that's what I'm trying to do very, very doggedly with Discovery. But the concept of totally eradicating the original series, it makes me feel old. It makes me feel, I feel in some ways like some sort of women's liberation person, where it's like, I fought for your rights to have 6 other series of Star Trek, and now you want to get rid of this one? The one that started? The one that we championed? Oh my God, that's crazy. And yet here we are. Here we are. I'm sitting in my garage, my cold garage, no longer spider-filled because it's so cold. The spiders, I don't know where they go. Where do spiders go when it gets cold? I don't know. I don't want to know. I sort of want to know, but not that much. But here I am, surrounded by all this Star Trek memorabilia. And I've decided that I'm going to have a little bit of fun right now. I'm going to cleanse my palate for me and for you by talking about something which is fun, but also something more I thought about, the more it did actually relate a little bit to Discovery and to Star Trek and to why I love Star Trek. And it comes to the pivotal moment of Star Trek. It falls almost on this balancing point of what Star Trek could become, what it was, what it could be, and some of the tenets, not David, that would make Star Trek and made Star Trek something that you wanted to come back to, and something that is problematic for Discovery. I only saw it a couple of times that it might need. And if someone is listening that has any sort of influence on the Discovery writers, maybe they could pass this along with them. For the past like 6, 8, or 10 months, I've been watching one segment of Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. Not Star Trek III Beyond. I don't actually remember what the title was, but Star Trek III, The Search for Spock. Actually, if you search Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, you'll get Star Trek III, The Search for Spock on Google. But if you search Star Trek III, you'll get Star Trek Beyond. Again, the eradication of everything that once was, as we slowly fade, we become the guardians of forever. But Star Trek III is in this nebulous area of a film that is an odd-numbered film and yet wants to be an even-numbered film. And if you don't know that this sort of Star Trek movie curse, which went on for at least 8 or 9 iterations, it went something like this, is that the odd-numbered films, 1, 3, 5, 7, and 9, were not the good films, while the even-numbered films, 2, 4, 6, and 8, were good. And everyone kind of bought in that because, well, I mean, it was easy to remember. It was like some sort of like Schoolhouse Rock mathematical thing. But whenever I thought about that, Star Trek III always kind of stuck out in my mind because Star Trek III is not a bad film. Star Trek III is a pretty good film. It is a film which deserves your attention as a historian or as someone who likes to watch movies. Now, it is flawed. There are problems with it. And my contention is that the second half of the film is not as good as the first half. And as I got deeper into it, there's a couple of really good scenes in this film, segments in this film, which are amazing and fun, surrounded by other not-so-good ones. And the scene that I really started to fixate on, the set piece that I really started to fixate on, is the stealing of the Enterprise. That's all we're going to talk about tonight. The stealing of the Enterprise. This whole episode is going to be about this, so hopefully it'll be a shorter podcast. It won't be, because it just won't. But I have a couple of clips I want to play for you, and we're just going to talk about it, because to me, it came in a moment where Star Trek could have gone a couple different directions, and this one segment pointed us into a direction that would set a precedent for fun for the rest of the series, while hearkening back to what made Star Trek great. We'll give you a little bit of backstory about Star Trek III, Star Trek II. Star Trek III is by default a lesser film than Star Trek II, because Star Trek III is beholden to Star Trek II. Star Trek III is the continuation of Star Trek II, where one was never asked for. Star Trek II is The Wrath of Khan. Great. Star Trek III is The Search for Spock, which begs the question, where is Spock? And if you don't know where Spock is, you have to go back and watch Star Trek II to find out where Spock is. And the answer is he's dead. That's a spoiler. I'm sorry about that, but he's dead. So you have this film which tries to answer this question which no one necessarily wanted to answer. Now, Star Trek II, as we've discussed before, was a film which was made for 1/7 the budget of the first film. It was almost an ABC movie of the week. They used existing sets and they cobbled together 3 different scripts to come up with this beautiful thing. Written by Harv Bennett and Nicholas Meyer in a flash. With Leonard Nimoy, who didn't want to come back, but he was kind of coaxed back because they promised him that he would have a death scene. William Shatner, who thought his career was over. Everyone else was just kind of like, sure, I'll take the paycheck. And somehow it all worked. And it worked so well. And they posited this amazing, amazing situation. What happens if Captain Kirk loses his best friend and second in command? And they left him all alone at the end of this movie with no expectation of ever coming back. And yet the best thing that happened and the worst thing that happened to this movie is that it was incredibly successful. And it begged for a sequel. Because Nicholas Meyer was smart enough to film a sequence where there was the life pod. Maybe it wasn't Nicholas Meyer. Maybe it was Harvey Bennett. I can't remember. Out in Central Park with the Mark V torpedo showing that Spock could still be alive. It gave us hope because, man, when we were sitting in that movie theater and the tears were streaming down our cheeks, we wanted anything to hang on to that would say, oh my God, this is the saddest film of all time. And so he shot this little extra scene, this little coda, this tag, if you will, in this day and age, where maybe Spock wasn't dead. No, it was impossible. He was dead. He was dead. And yet in this town, money brings anything back to life. And with the huge box office of Star Trek II, immediately people started thinking about Star Trek III. They had to have Star Trek III, and they had to have Spock back, which is phenomenal, except it was a bad situation for Paramount because all of a sudden everyone wants Spock back except Spock. Leonard Nimoy was like, I don't want to come back, or he did, but now he has all this leverage, doesn't he? Because he's not under contract. This isn't like Marvel where they sign you to like a 6-picture deal and they know exactly what's going to happen to your character 10 years in advance and you can't escape. This was like, yeah, we'll sign you for one movie, Star Trek II, and then that's it. Oh, what? Oh, this made a huge amount of money? And everyone wants to have Spock come back? And that actor doesn't want to come back. Huh, what are we going to do? Well, Leonard Nimoy wanted to direct. So you know what? He got to direct. So Leonard Nimoy became the director of Star Trek III. Star Trek III is sort of like an improv game where you try to create all the most ridiculous circumstances that you can for your improv friend and then see if they can get out of it. Okay, the Enterprise is almost destroyed. Kirk has a son. Kirk has a former girlfriend. And his best friend is dead. What are you going to do? Harv Bennett had to kind of dig in and kind of write his way out of a lot of different boxes there and came up with, in general, a pretty good film. The film continues on the theme of grieving after Star Trek II. Now, Star Trek II, I think, at the end, did a beautiful job of dealing with the death of Spock in a short period of time. They didn't waste a lot of time going over Kirk's sadness. I mean, they had the funeral scene. It's so beautiful. It's that immediacy of grieving, that immediate loss, which Star Trek II dealt so well with, the funeral, and then Kirk talking to David Marcus and trying to come to grips with the fact that he has a son and he's lost his best friend, and it's short scenes, but everyone seems to kind of come to a grips as they see the son, kind of, you know, coming over the new Genesis planet. Star Trek III continues that on and has the lingering effects of grieving. So it's kind of like a diminished, but still an interesting area to look at. The continued loss of someone. And of course, within that, they start layering in the idea that maybe he's not dead, as McCoy starts acting kind of wonky. And eventually, when Sarek shows up, Spock's father, we discover that in fact his Katra, his essence, basically his hard drive, was not backed up into Kirk, and Sarek is furious. Why didn't you take him to Mount Solea and do all this sort of stuff, which is all new for the Vulcan lore? But you know what? We're only 3 films in and 76 episodes, 3 seasons of this with Vulcan mythology, so you get a buy on that, right? You get a buy, sure. All Vulcans eventually kind of store their minds in the cloud, and that's okay. We're okay with that because we want this to work, right? If you're an audience member sitting in, and I was there, sitting in the theater, you're going, huh, the Katra. Well, okay, let's give them a buy on this one. Let's see where this goes. They figure out that it is McCoy who is the one who has Spock's brain. And through all of this wrangling, we also come into another subplot too, which is the idea that the creation of this device has been interpreted as a weapon. Now, this is interesting too. This is the atomic bomb, basically, the Federation has created without telling anyone, especially the Klingons. And the Klingons look at it as a threat. Now, if you want to point to one of the issues also with Star Trek III, unfortunately, I'm going to pin a little bit on our Kirkbusters friend. And if you haven't listened to the Kirkbusters episode, you've got to listen to that one. We won't go too deeply into that, but Commander Krug, played by Christopher Lloyd, is the bad guy in this one. And if they go from the great villain of Khan, who had been built, had been backlogged for 15 years, waiting and stewing to fight Kirk again, you get this Klingon who has a weird puppet dog and lost his wife, I guess, in the beginning, but it wasn't super clear about all that. And so his grief is supposed to mirror what Kirk feels, but we don't feel any of that. So it's kind of a messy, weird thing. And at the end of the day, it's Doc Brown and Jim Mignatowski talking. And so that makes it even a little bit weirder, doesn't it? But be that as it may, meanwhile, McCoy is trying desperately to get to Genesis. He's trying to get to Genesis to find his body, to get Spock's brain back to his body. Now, structurally, this is also a little bit problematic for this movie, because how does Spock's brain know that his body is still there? Why doesn't he want to go to Vulcan? This is a big problem. Why don't they just go to Vulcan and transfer McCoy's Katra Spock brain to Mount Sileo? It becomes a little bit of a buy again, which further diminishes the film. But it's okay, because it sets up all the circumstances for what's going to happen next. They are forbidden from going to the Genesis planet, but they have to go to the Genesis planet. The word is no. We are therefore going anyways. That's what Kirk says. And here comes, out of nowhere, a heist movie. For 9 minutes in the middle of Star Trek III, The Search for Spock, we jump into a heist movie. We are grieving. We are dealing with grieving, with loss, with political intrigue of a new weapon, with remorse from a Klingon for his dead wife. And then all of a sudden, we've got to steal the Enterprise. And you know what that is? That's fun. That's a lot of fun. And here's how we know it's going to be a fun scenario. Listen to this.
Make it quick, Admiral. They are moving him to the Federation Funny Farm.
Yes, poor friend. I hear he's fruity as a nutcake.
He's fruity as a nutcake. Now, if you don't know the phrase, it's nutty as a fruitcake. But fruity as a nutcake is something that everyone in 1984, when this came out, I think it was 84, I haven't done my research on this film, I've never seen it before, knew. They knew the phrase, nutty as a fruitcake. But fruity as a nutcake instantly cues us that something is a little bit off. Something's a little bit more fun. It gives us our first legitimate laugh probably in the entire movie franchise that's not like necessarily based in character. It's just silly. It's just a silly, goofy line. The scene continues on, and Kirk has this great thing where he walks into McCoy, who's like laying on this weird like table. I guess that's where you sleep on, kind of like a table if you're crazy in the 23rd century. And he gives him a Vulcan sign, and he says this.
Jim, how many fingers do I have up?
That's not very damn funny.
Your sense of humor's returned.
The hell it has. What's that?
Lexarin.
Lexarin? What for?
You're suffering from a Vulcan mind meld, Doctor.
That green-blooded son of a bitch. It's his revenge for all those arguments he lost.
Listen to all those jokes. So many of them. How many fingers am I holding up? That's sort of a meta joke right there. You know, how many fingers am I holding up is, you know, kind of the concussion protocol of the day. Not very damn funny. Well, at least your sense of humor's returned. The hell it has. And then he's giving him the Lexrol. And then we start getting into the characters a little more. We start digging a little more. What's that for? You know, Spock has mind melded with you. And then that green-blooded bastard is his revenge for getting back at me for all those arguments he lost. great, fun, funny lines, which starts out a little absurd and then get deeper into the character. Now, of course, if you're a Star Trek aficionado, you know that Spock did not lose many battles with McCoy, but McCoy sees it differently, so it's funny on a couple of different levels. You start off with this crazy fruity as a nutcake thing, and by the time you get to the end of it, it's a joke within a joke. Great stuff. Meanwhile, we have Sulu coming in. And this is where it gets really kind of interesting and fun. Because Sulu is now suddenly part of all of this, and that's different. That's different because a lot of times Star Trek is Kirk, Spock, and maybe McCoy. Occasionally, it's everybody. Watch iMUD with the robot episode. Watch any of these Star Trek series, and lots of times it's the captain and maybe a couple others. But when it's everybody and everyone's having fun, then we're having fun. Sulu comes in and he's already posing as like a Federation officer who needs Captain Kirk. He sees a guy yawning. He says, "You know, keeping you busy, Tiny, keeping you busy." And then the guy says, "Don't get smart, Tiny," or something like that. The other guard goes in to get Kirk and then.
"Don't get smart, Tiny."
"Admiral, Starfleet Command."
"Sick. Here, take a look." "Side elevator. Agents on their way up."
"Don't call me Tiny."
Okay, so let's break down a couple things we had there. First of all, we have this kind of tiny thing, which is kind of a funny, you know, setup and punchline where this giant guard calls Sulu Tiny. And then the other guard comes in and Kirk punches him. And did you notice? They start the music right on the punch. A little glissando of harp and strings and kind of dun, 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 dun. It's light. It's fun. It's frothy. So it could have been darker. It could have been like, "Oh my God, we're gonna bust him out." But instead, it's fun. It's a romp. We cut back to Sulu, who is now just kicking this guy's ass. He's got him in like a little arm bar from behind. And then he gives him a full-on sort of judo flip. 1984, maybe Sulu knows karate kind of thing. I don't know where they got that from, but he flips this giant guy. And then they get the heck out of there. But as he does, he says, "Don't call me Tiny." A nice callback to the beginning of that scene. Now we're in for some fun. They get in the elevator and they say, Kirk says, "Hey, Kobayashi Maru 1 to Kobayashi Maru 2. Now we're having even more fun. Hey, if you watch Star Trek 2, you know about the Kobayashi Maru. That was like a horrible, horrible thing. And now it's fun. They're setting sail for the Promised Land. You're taking me to the Promised Land? What are friends for?" All right, we switch over now to the Excelsior. Now, the Excelsior, first of all, the Excelsior is a great design of a ship. If you haven't seen an episode with the Excelsior in it, they ported it over to the Next Generation because it's such a damn good-looking ship. And when they showed it in the beginning of Star Trek 3, you're like, wow, it's like a big bathtub design for the hull, for the secondary hull. And it's sweeping and big. And even though it's the bad guy ship, well, not necessarily bad, it's the police ship. It's the authority. And it's bigger and it's better. And that's everything that's being kind of reinforced in this, in another subplot. As the Enterprise is to be decommissioned, the Excelsior is going to take its place. And we have the captain here, Captain Stiles. I looked it up. I had to look up. I remember. I believe the actor's name is Robert B. Seeking, though, because I remember that. He was in Hill Street Blues. And this guy, he's a great actor. He was in the show called Hill Street Blues. And he played kind of an officious SWAT commander, always kind of prim and proper, you know, kind of a conservative kind of guy. And even though it took you out a little bit, knowing that, like, oh, I know this actor. It's kind of like when Christian Slater showed up, in the Excelsior again. This is just kind of like the guest star, special guest star ship. But even though you knew who he was, you also knew what he brought, which was this sort of smarminess for us. So let's go to the club to go to the hunt. And he confronts Scotty, who is now the engineer of the Excelsior. He's on the other team. And he's like, Commander Scott, looking forward to breaking some of the Enterprise's old speed records tomorrow morning. Right there, he's calling the Enterprise out. Already, we're being demoted because this ship is better, and Scotty has to be a part of this. But we sense that something else is going on there. And he's going to the transporter room. Where is he going? Who knows? But then from there, we jump over to Uhura. Look at this. We've got everybody in play. Everyone's doing something. Uhura, she's at this transporter room in Space Dock 1. Space Dock 1, not necessarily the best name, but still pretty good. She's in Space Dock 1 with Mr. Adventure. This guy in the show is called Mr. Adventure. That's the name of his character. We don't know the name of this lieutenant who is next to Uhura. But they're kind of in the backwater, the worst job in Starfleet, to sit in this little transporter room in Space Dock 1 and, I guess, beam people from someplace to someplace inside a space dock. And Uhura's just sitting there. And once again, we get the theme of kind of obsolescence and coming to the end of your time when Mr. Adventure's talking about, oh, yeah, you know, you can be here since you're at the end of your career, but I'm just looking for excitement and adventure. And then who walks in but Kirk and McCoy and Sulu? And Mr. Adventure's like, what the hell is this? This is all crazy. And I tell you, Nichelle Nichols, she doesn't have a lot to do in this film, but man, she lights it up in this scene. She turns around on that guy with a phaser and she's like, how's this? You like this? Is this adventure? Get your heart racing, huh? Go sit in the closet. Dude sits in the closet and then she beams them on with all her hopes and prayers. It's a nice little scene for her. She's having a part in this too. Everybody has a part in this. They get on board the Enterprise. The lights literally turn on the bridge as Scotty has been busy rigging it up so a chimpanzee and two recruits could run it. And Kirk doesn't take that too hard. And then he turns to the crew. And this is another important thing too. I'm just kind of rambling right now. I'm excited about this. But as much fun as we've had with this, there's also stakes to this. They're stealing the Enterprise. And so he turns to his crew of Scotty and McCoy and Sulu and Chekov, who's in the weirdest, pinkest, like little boy blue kind of Dutch outfit that you've ever seen. Look it up. And he says this to them.
My friends, I can't ask you to go any further. Dr. McCoy and I have to do this. The rest of you do not.
Admiral, we're losing precious time.
What course, please, Admiral?
Mr. Scott?
I'd be grateful, Admiral, if you'd give the word.
Gentlemen, may the wind be at our backs. Stations, please.
Oh, do you hear everything that's going on there? He says, gentlemen, I have to go on with Dr. McCoy, but the rest of you, you don't have to go any further. And without hesitation, they say, Admiral, we're wasting precious time. He's handing it over. And this is Shatner and Kirk handing it over to his friends. Now, for Shatner, it's a long road. It's a long, hard road for him to find any sort of redemptive portion of his life where the rest of his cast can actually look at him and say, he's been a friend to us. I mean, even Nimoy, towards the end of his life, kind of distanced himself from Shatner. And it's been difficult. But here, Kirk realizes that he can't do it alone. He could try, but he goes to these people. And these people who have been with him for 15 years now, without hesitation, they say, yes, we're all in. And you know what else is going on too? That damn great James Horner music is kicking up. James Horner was such a great composer. Now, let me just tell you something. He does steal from himself. If you listen to Aliens, you're going to find music from Krull in there. You're going to find him taking music from Glory and porting it over from other stuff. Aliens and Star Trek 2 have very similar themes as well. He borrowed stuff from himself. But man, when he was on his game, there was nobody better. And this music is a continuation of Star Trek 2. Someone, I think I read somewhere that he originally, I don't know, that he was going to make this part one and part two of this. Like, he always had this music in mind for the sequel, which I don't understand what any of that means. Anyways, he's in beautiful form here. And the music just swells. And you can hear when all three of his crew members tell Kirk, we're behind you. You hear that dun 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 dun. You hear that original series theme distantly echoing in. This is what Star Trek's about. This is about camaraderie, about working together for a common goal, about working together to help a friend. All right, so the Enterprise lights up and starts to pull out of the station. Now, they're still in the space dock. They're still inside this gigantic space dock. I don't know why you would put a spaceship inside a spaceship of that size. But we get this beautiful, majestic look here of the spaceship starting to pull out very, very slowly. For once, I think one of the best things about having this spaceship inside a spaceship, which I don't think we ever saw again, well, except maybe in Beyond. But that was kind of crazy. It was like they were going in Tomorrowland or something. It was like they were going through big, you know, clear, transparent aluminum tubes. And it was like a giant hamster race or something. But with this, strangely enough, having the Enterprise and the Excelsior inside a larger ship gave you a better sense of scale. Probably because it wasn't framed against a gigantic planet or a gigantic sun or the vastness and emptiness of space. But in the distance, you could see the space station behind it, and you could see ships flying in front of it. So in some ways, it made them even bigger and grander. I guess maybe we have a frame of reference for actual nautical ships being launched. But here, we have this sense of grandeur as the ship pulls out. And then we get this another cool scene where Captain Stiles is sitting in his room, like literally filing his nails. He's so aristocratic doing this. He's got a little baton, like a little patent baton. I'm so excited about this. But we have this little exchange. I love this line.
Yellow alert. Captain to the bridge. Yellow alert.
Bridge, this is the captain. How can you have a yellow alert in space dock?
Sir, someone is stealing the Enterprise.
I'm on my way.
Alert. Yellow alert. Off station. Yellow alert. Alert. Yellow alert. Yellow alert.
1 minute to space doors.
You get that grandeur of the music. And if you haven't seen that scene, there's a cool section where there's like this weird restaurant in the space dock. And as the Enterprise is pulling away, there's like giant like windows so you can see ships come in. And as the Enterprise comes in, everyone's like eating lunch. You're like, oh my God, look at the Enterprise. Ooh, I got kind of screwed up. Whoa, hey. But this is like after hours and there's some like busboy cleaning up and he's sitting there just kind of like, what the hell do I do? It's yellow alert and the Enterprise is being stolen and I need to get these dishes washed. And why do I have to wash dishes in the 23rd century? Is there no other way to do this? Can we not beam these dishes or beam the food like remnants off the dishes and make them clean? Why have my life choices led me here to like bussing this table while Captain Kirk is stealing his ship? I wish I would have maybe not joined Starfleet. Or maybe join Starfleet instead of joining like the restaurant corps, like the Army Corps of Restauranteurs. Kind of lost my mind here a little bit of that. That's all right. But we get this sense of grandeur as the ships are pulling out. The Enterprise is pulling out. And they're going to the space doors. And I tell you what, if you've never felt anything about trying to walk towards a door, you've got to watch this sequence because there's like a good 2 minute sequence where they're slowly backing up towards a door and they're trying to get it to open. Walk backwards towards a door and hope that you can somehow open it before you run into it. That's how exciting it is. And yet somehow it is. Somehow it's incredibly exciting. And the Excelsior is slowly chasing after it at 1/4 impulse, which doesn't make any sense right now. I know that. They say it's 1/4 impulse, but who cares? It's fine. It's fine. We'll give them credit. Like if it's really 1/4 impulse, like they would like smash through the door, like, you know, in a millionth of a second or something, but they're going at 1/4 impulse, probably like it's some sort of weird conversion, but they're slowly going towards the door and Scotty is working desperately to get the doors open. McCoy's freaking out. And at the last minute, the doors open up with the amazing James Horner music telling us that this is actually something important, something cool. The doors opening is the most amazing thing you've ever seen. And they fly out there. And then we're rewarded with sort of this seafaring music like, ah, we're out into outer space. and we're floating, but there's still problems because the Excelsior is coming. The Excelsior, it's also coming to the space doors, and oddly enough, if Scotty could open the space doors, you'd think maybe he could close the space doors, but no, he did not think about that, or he didn't need to worry about it, because maybe he had something else up his sleeve. But anyways, they're getting ready, they're circling around the space dock, getting ready to warp out of the way, and the Excelsior's following them, and then we have this one last great exchange there as they're getting ready to warp, where Captain Stiles somehow breaks in and talks directly to Kirk through the intercom and tells him this.
Excelsior closing to 4,000 meters, sir.
Scotty, we'll need everything you have.
Aye, sir. What drive standing by?
Kirk.
You do this, you'll never sit in the captain's chair again.
Warp speed.
Aye, sir.
You hear that? Commander Stiles just lays out for him. You do this, you'll never sit in the captain's chair again. The one thing that James T. Kirk loves more than anything else, he said it back in the Naked Time, to be the captain of the Enterprise. It's the one thing he wants. It's the one thing which he's good at. He loses his admiralty in the next movie to become the captain again. It's the one thing that he desires to do. And this guy says, dude, you do this, and you are never going to sit in this chair again. And yet there's one more thing that he loves more than that. Well, he enjoys, he fancies, and that's his friend, Mr. Spock. And so without any hesitation, I mean, I've watched that scene where he says, warp speed. And I wonder, did they add that in? Was he listening to that? Was Shatner listening to that? Someone read that off stage, that line? I can't tell. Because there is no, it does not register for one second the consequences of what he's about to do. It seems as though he hears it. It seems as though there's enough of a pause so that he would hear that, but with not one iota of consideration of saying, maybe I should consider this, maybe I should think about it, maybe we should talk about this. No, he's warp speed. Let's go. And then they leave. We have the final kind of coda to all of this, where the mighty Excelsior is getting ready to follow them and latch a tractor beam on them and stop them, because all this is for naught, because this is a better ship. It's a faster ship. It has transwarp, something never before or after talked about. It's a mysterious thing, a cross warp. Don't know what that means, but they all get ready to go. Miguel Ferrer is in there. There's a little cameo in there as well. And then all of a sudden, everything breaks down, and the ship literally sounds like a car stalling out, which is a little wah wah. Because Scotty pulled out some of like lug nuts from the transwarp when he gives them to Dr. McCoy, and McCoy says, nice of you to tell me. And then Kirk says, that's what you get for not going to, to meetings. I can't remember the last line. I've blown the last line. That's what you get for not coming to meeting. Damn, I can't remember. It doesn't matter because that's a great sequence, right? That's 9 minutes of that film. But that part, that whole segment lifted the audience up and made it so much fun. And then we get some other nonsense, and we get the whole Genesis retconning where there's proto-matter and David has to die and Savick is different because Kirstie Alley decided she did not want to be in the film, which was her choice, and she made a good choice because she did Cheers for a whole bunch of time. But it was so weird to see Robin Savick in there all of a sudden. And then there's like puppet worms that are trying to kill Commander Krug, and then there's, they're in a sound stage instead of Hawaii where they wanted to be, but for some reason they didn't, the budget wouldn't work out, and then that set caught on fire, and you can tell I know a lot about what happened afterwards. And this was probably the high point of the film. There are a couple other high points. One is where they actually fight the bird of prey, and Kirk decides to blow up the ship. Although, you know, I mean, it was fine, but it was a sacrifice that they had to make. And then at the end, when Spock comes back, that's kind of nice. But here's why I like this scene. Here's why I watch this scene over and over again. And I said it earlier. It's fun. It's a fun sequence where all of our lead characters are doing something, actively engaged in a combined effort for a singular goal. And they're having fun, and we're having fun. And I said earlier that this is something that I'm missing in Discovery. And it's true. If you watch the original series, there's a lot of goofy, fun episodes where our characters, not only the big three, but the other characters having a good time. Same thing with Next Generation, same thing with Deep Space Nine, same thing with all the other ones. I counted maybe 1.5 times when our characters actually had fun in Discovery. The one that comes to mind is when they're trying to fool people on the Mirror Universe side that they are, in fact, the actual crew of the Discovery, the bad people crew, the Mirror Universe crew. And you have Lorca pretending to be evil Lorca, or pretending to be the engineer. And it's fun. It's a fun little 2-minute sequence out of 15 episodes. You need to have this every once in a while. You need to take your characters and have them all go on a little bit of a romp, a little bit of a fun time there. And this was at the perfect time. Like I said, this was a counterbalance between the darkness of Star Trek II: The Wrath of Khan and the complete lightheartedness of Star Trek IV: The Voyage Home. It sat right in the middle. It was a fun little romp with high stakes. To save our friend, we have to humorously steal the Enterprise. And in doing so, they stole their hearts. Yes, they did. You will forget about what I just said right there, but you'll remember everything else. Star Trek III is a flawed but good film overall. It has many sequences which are good, and in the end analysis, the stealing of the Enterprise is such a powerful segment that points to a way for our audience to relate to these characters in a fun way, that it allowed for the series to continue without continuing to delve down into darkness. It gave us a way out of the death of Spock. It gave us some relief and some fun. And that allowed Star Trek IV, and then Star Trek VI, and the Next Generation, and on and on and on. Until right now, when I get to spend 15 weeks bitching about another Star Trek series. All because of stealing the Enterprise. Which stole our hearts. I'll say it again. All right, so that's it. That's it for tonight. That's all we're going to do. That's all I'm going to do. I don't care. This was so good. And I'll post the clip on our Facebook page. Hey, check it out. We had some lively, spirited debate about what the grade should be for Discovery. Log on. I'll put up this clip. Maybe I'll post another question. Let's have some good times. Hey, hit me up at Mike McCafferty on Twitter. Leave me a review on iTunes that boosts our rankings and other fools will come on and check us out. Excuse me, I burped. Next time we will have probably the Doctor, probably Jason, who knows, maybe some other people. I want to get everyone together. I want to get everyone together and just talk about Discovery. I want to get John Stern back. I want to get lots of people back, maybe Dan Merle, and just talk about what we saw there. Because I could be wrong. I don't know if I am, but I could be wrong. Because some people tell me I'm wrong. But they're wrong, right? I don't know. But we're going to figure this out, you and me. Because we're a team. We're a crew. And my friends, I could not do this without you. So thank you very much. I'm Mike McCafferty. Just want to talk about Star Trek.
Destruct sequence completed and engaged.
Don't you understand?
Error, flaw, imperfection.
When the train comes in, everybody rides.
Blah, 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 blah,
blah. No, blah, blah, blah!
Hello, I'm Dave Ross.
Hey, and I'm Hampton Yunt.
And we host Suicide Buddies on Starburns Audio.
That's right. It's a podcast about suicide, but not to make light of it. We actually talk about suicidal thoughts, depression, kind of with a sense of levity that Dave and I have with each other. He's my best friend. Come on.
Yeah, we're buddies. Suicide Buddies.
That's the title.
One of our favorite episodes that we've recorded so far is about this guy, Jan Pataki, who was a Polish aristocrat in the 19th century. Mm-hmm. And he, one of the reasons it's possible that he killed himself is that he thought he was a werewolf.
Oh.
Check out a clip. It also makes me think, like, we were talking about in the Norway black metal episode, how, like, just the culture of your surroundings can affect you. Like, yeah. He's in a castle in Poland. He's like, I mean, if you lived in a castle in Poland and no one knew anything about anything, you might be like, I'm a bat. I'm probably a bat.
That's like literally what happened to Batman. He literally is in his mansion. He's like, you know what? Fuck it. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I'm a bat.
I'm a
bat that helps people.
I'm a bat that helps people.
I
don't know what you want from me. And my girlfriend, she's a cat. She's a cat.
My girlfriend's a cat.
She steals things. She's a woman who steals things. She's a cat. I'm a bat.
I'm a bat. I help people. She's a cat. We fight a penguin.
My